This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. Morning, Andy.
Good to be here.
Yeah, another day, another podcast. Right on. Well, we have a special guest with us today, and we're going to jump right into that. We are going to look at one of his books that he has written and has just been published not too long ago. On the line with us, we have Dr. Tim Mulhoff. He is a professor of communications at Biola University in La Mirada, California. He teaches classes in family communication, interpersonal communication, apologetics, gender, and conflict resolution. He completed a PhD in communications at the University of North Carolina. And he is on staff with Biola's Center for Marriage and Relationships. He is an author, speaker, co-host. Also, he has his own podcast with another guy, The Art of Relationship. So we're here to talk today with him about his recent book called Defending Your Marriage, The Reality of Spiritual Battle. So he's no stranger to the podcast and not a stranger to the conference either. So he's been to our conference a number of years ago. So welcome back, Tim. Great to have you on the podcast again.
Oh, thank you for having me. I look forward to this.
So we're going to jump right into it. And you've been involved with counseling and marriage development for many, many years now. So my first question to you is, why did you write this book at this time? And why do you feel we have to defend our marriage, like your title says?
Well, I read a book that really spurred my thinking. It's by Clint Arnold. He's the dean of Talbot Seminary at Biola University about spiritual battle. And, you know, it's just one of those books you pick up and you just kind of throw in your suitcase and you think, oh, this looks kind of interesting. And as I read it, I realized spiritual battle, spiritual opposition is not even a blip on my screen as a Western Christian. So as I'm talking to couples, you know, that are having conflict and, you know, difficult times, I would think to all the normal things like, you know, are you listening to each other? Are you seeking to find common ground? But never once did it pop up on my screen that this might be spiritual battle. And some of the stats I read in Clint's book just shocked me. Like 25% of everything Jesus talked about had to do with spiritual opposition, spiritual battle. And yet that wasn't even a blip on my screen. And it really convicted me to begin to look at relationships through a biblical lens.
Now, I got to tell you, Tim, reading your book, and you bring this up, the importance of recognizing the spiritual battle at play, particularly in things like marriage. I really resonated with that because I grew up in more of a conservative background where Satan is rarely, if ever, talked about in the topic of spiritual battle. It's just something that rarely gets addressed. And so as soon as you got into that, I mean, that just made a lot of sense for me. However, it's interesting, not so much for Terry. Terry, you know, you grew up in more of a Pentecostal background.
Yeah, I was in the Pentecostal tradition up until I was about 21.
And now you would say that in some of the traditions that you've been a part of, there's a demon around every corner.
Absolutely. There was something there all the time. And there seemed to be just a lot of fear that happened within the people's lives because of this idea of these demons or Satan is after you all the time. Yeah.
Now, Tim, in your book, you know, I believe it's on page 5, you deal with this quite quickly that, listen, there's a balance that needs to be struck here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, C.S. Lewis is so good on this. I actually dedicate a whole chapter to him. The very last chapter of the book is, let's take a look at the Screwtape Letters, one of his classics, where he imagines dialogue among demons. And let's see how that applies to a marriage. But Lewis would say, yeah, we need to be balanced. We can't subscribe everything to Satan. But I think, so Terry, that's really interesting that you come from a tradition like that. But most of the people I talk to don't come from tradition competitions like that.
Yeah.
And they would say, so I asked my students every year, when was the last sermon you heard on spiritual battle? When was the last sermon you heard on the devil? And all the students are like, oh, I've never heard a sermon on the devil. I've never heard a sermon on spiritual battle. I think that kind of unbalance shows that at least the Western church, that we're very leery to talk about this issue. And in the first chapter of the book, I explore why I think we're leery. I think mostly it's embarrassment. You know, having a PhD from UNC at Chapel Hill, imagine me saying to people, oh, I actually take the devil literally. I do believe in a literal physical devil. They would have looked at me like, you are crazy. That's insane. So I think sometimes it's embarrassment on the church, and we don't want to overreact. But I think most of the friends I interact with, we're not even close to overreacting. It's just not even a possibility that Satan may be disrupting your marriage, or Satan may be disrupting your church, or when you try to share apologetically, that Satan's trying to place barriers in front of you. So for me, it was the imbalance that really caught my attention. And then I had what I think was an experience with the demonic myself that kind of sealed the deal that I need to start thinking about this, writing about this, and exploring this issue.
So it seems that there's these two extremes that you can have here. One where there's a demon around every corner and you begin to live in fear. And then the other one where Satan's never, you know, and demons are never talked about at all and you live in ignorance. Now, in my own experience, I was more in the ignorance portion of things. And spiritual warfare really never became a reality to me until I became a pastor and started preaching. And this is something that I will often tell people. You're never really going to experience, you know, spiritual warfare until Satan cares about you. You know, and when you begin to, it's interesting to me that when you start to put yourself out there, whether that's preaching or getting married, you know, and then where you go from there, you're going to experience different levels, I would think, of spiritual warfare. And in particular, I've noticed preaching, the amount of spiritual warfare there has really surprised me. Now, I have a pastoral apprentice right now who's been apprenticing under me for the last number of years. And this is something that I talked to him about. His name's Daniel. And I said, listen, Daniel, you need to be prepared that when you start to preach, that you're going to be entering into a battle that you haven't probably experienced yet. And it's been interesting having to walk through that with him.
I would totally agree with that, that when you pop your head up and you start to share your faith with other people, you take a risk at work or with people that you go to school with, that, yeah, you are making yourself a spiritual target. But in the book, I explored the idea, though, with all of us, Satan may want to be doing preparatory work. So if that moment ever arises that you pop your head up and you start to share your faith and you start to take steps of faith, Satan already has done preparatory work to reel you back in. For example, Sun Tzu in The Art of War, I quote in the book, says, the most important thing about a battle is environment. So you want to chop down trees, you want to dam up a river, you want to make sure you get the high ground, because if you control the environment long before the battle even starts, then you have a huge advantage. So I find it fascinating that John says the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. And so I think Satan is already doing things culturally that makes, when that attack finally does happen, when you do take that step of faith, he's already laid the groundwork to reel you back in, particularly when it comes to your marriage. Like, one of the things I look at is this idea that marriage is a contract, not a covenant. Mm-hmm. And so a contract is, and we know this well, right, in the West, you don't fulfill your part of the contract, I'm not fulfilling mine. We had our house painted. Well, there's no way I'm paying the guy all of the money up front. Nobody would ever do that. Why? Because I pay you half the money, and then I judge whether you fulfill the rest of the contract. And if you didn't, I withhold the rest of the money. So that's exactly how marriage works in the West, is you do 50%, I'll do 50%, right? But if you're not doing your part, I'm not going to do my part. So Satan has already gotten that into our mindset when it comes to marriage, so that when the hard times really do hit, when we're taking steps of faith, you start to realize, hey, my spouse isn't fulfilling her responsibilities, and so why should I fulfill mine? And you get a totally different flavor of marriage when you go to Paul in Ephesians chapter 5. So I think Satan is working on all of us, but particularly when you start to take steps of faith, he really, I think, comes at you in some fairly significant ways.
And maybe it's in that, at that time that you begin to realize that it's already been taking place and groundwork has already been laid.
thoughts have already been planted that he's now going to work on. A huge part of the book is this idea that Satan can plant thoughts in your mind. He can't read your mind. He's not omniscient. We don't get any evidence that Satan is omnipresent nor omniscient. But we do get evidence biblically that Satan can plant thoughts in your mind. So I don't doubt that there are certain thoughts that he's been playing via culture, Hollywood, classes you take, that he's been laying the groundwork of these thoughts that bounce around in your head. And then when he needs them, he can really start to go back to these thoughts and play on these different kind of themes.
I know that this has been the case for myself. And as I was reading your book, one of the thoughts that was coming to my mind is, you know, defending your marriage begins before you even get married. And dealing with a lot of what's already been planted in the situations that you've perhaps already experienced. So for me, one of the big things that I dealt with was fear. Fear of marriage, fear of screwing up. I came from a broken family where my parents had separated, and having these fears that I'm like my dad and I'm going to make the same mistakes that my dad made. And I remember when I was dating my wife, when we were dating, I tried breaking up with her on a number of occasions. One time I didn't call her for 2 weeks, and I'll never forget this. She called me up and she said, if you're going to dump me, she said, she goes, you're going to do it like a man. And one of the things I've loved about this woman is that she's realized that my insecurities and my fears, and willing to walk with me through that, realizing, man, that there's been spiritual battle that's been taking place in my family for years that I'm needing to wrestle through as I come into marriage.
But what I love about that is two things. One, we teach a class at Biola called the Christian Relationships class. It's about 150 students, where we want to get students on the front end, right? These are all undergrads. None of them are married. And yet they all have these cultural ideas about marriage, either from Hollywood, you know, overly romanticized views of marriage, or, you know, this divorce culture that they're all steeped in and things like that. So I love the idea of getting them on the front end and teaching them a theology of marriage, teaching them what spiritual battle looks like, what is the purpose of being a Christian, you know, God's kingdom and all that kind of stuff. So I love the idea of on the front end. But I also want to make a comment that everything you described is, I've experienced that. My parents had a really rough marriage. So I went into marriage thinking conflict was wrong. I was not going to do conflict, because if I did it, that was like my parents.
I thought I had to break up with my girlfriend because we had a fight.
Oh, yeah. But think about that. Nobody would recognize that as spiritual battle. So when I was interviewing couples for the book, I would say to them, hey, have you experienced spiritual battle in the last year? And the answer was no. The majority of time, it was absolutely no. Because then I would ask them the second question, okay, what do you think spiritual battle looks like? And virtually all of the couples said, oh, it's these big dramatic things. It's, you know, Satan trying to get us to get a divorce. It's these guttural Latin voices. So you see the effect of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So I go back in the book and say, but it's interesting that in Genesis, the serpent, Satan, is described as being crafty. And in Hebrew, crafty means subtle. So if Satan is using subtle ways to get at us, ways that aren't easily discernible, then maybe spiritual battle is happening much more. Now, in my life as a Christian, I can point to three instances where I think Satan went at me full frontal. I mean, it was dramatic. But only three times since me being a Christian since age 13, I think he's working underneath the surface to get to me. And yes, he can do dramatic things, but I think it backfired in my life because it kind of woke me up to the reality of spiritual battle. So I think Satan said, okay, that doesn't work with Mielhoff. Let's go back underground.
Isn't it interesting in Hollywood today that there is some truth in that, you know, Satan's often shown more as this good-looking kind of lawyer type, not this red demon with a pitchfork kind of thing.
Yeah, the transformation of Satan in pop culture is fascinating to watch. You get both. You get the really dramatic moments, but you also get this really subtle, almost seductive view of evil and of Satan. And I think we have to be, I think there's movies we should see right? I don't think every movie about the occult is off limits. For example, The Conjuring is the true story of the first Protestant couple to be sanctioned by the Vatican to actually do exorcisms. So The Conjuring is a story about one of their most dramatic cases. And then we had a Biola grad make a movie called The Exorcism of Emily Rose that is a fascinating movie about, is spiritual reality on par with science? Are both of them equally valid ways to interpret a woman experiencing extreme physical difficulties? So I think there's certain movies we probably should see that would help us conceptualize spiritual battle in a biblical way. Obviously, there's a lot of junk you want to stay away from. But I think we have to be very careful. But pick some good movies that will give you a good Christian perspective of what this might look like.
So in your first chapter, you say this. You say New Testament writers advocate for that the first step isn't to learn a set of spiritual warfare techniques, but rather to gather information. What is that gathering information?
So, you know, in the West, we're pragmatists. So it's like, hey, give me 5 ways to fix my marriage. Give me 6 ways to forgive my spouse. Give me, you know, 8 ways to be an effective parent. We don't want to take any time to get the theory of it, to gather knowledge. So I find it fascinating that the writers of the New Testament say the very first thing you should do is be aware of the schemes of the evil one. And so first, who's Satan and why in the world would Satan... This is what I get from couples all the time. Hey, listen, we can barely pay the budget. We can barely raise our 3 kids. We are not a threat to Satan. Why? You know, why? We can barely take care of the dog. Why? How in the world are we a threat to the evil one? And that's a great question. So the answer to that is that Satan, we get pictures of him from Ezekiel and from Isaiah, and we learn that what he most wanted was to be on par with God. He wanted a kingdom that he could rule. He wanted glory. He wanted worship. And he was deeply offended when we learn that human beings, as described in the Psalms, are just a little lower than angels. Some manuscripts say they're even on par with angels. That's how much God loves the human race made in his image. Well, some would argue that was the last straw for Satan, because now planet Earth has been given to humans when Satan wanted a place all along that he could run and be worshipped. And so the rebellion happens in heaven. We know that Satan loses. We know that he is banished with other angels to planet Earth. And this is what I like about the book, and I think resonates with your podcast. Let's not shy away from the hard questions. Right? Mm-hmm. I think we do a great disservice in our families and in our classrooms when we don't handle the really hard questions, like, why would God create Satan in the first place? Second, when he rebels, why in the world would God send him to planet Earth, where you have the first humans, Adam and Eve, and they're kind of blindsided by this crafty serpent that seduces them, and it's the fall of the human race? I don't think we do any favors to anyone when we ignore those really hard questions. And so in my book, I try to answer those questions, you know, using theologians and Christian apologists to do so. But let's not avoid these hard questions that students have, our kids have, and maybe even we ourselves have.
Well, let's jump into some of those hard questions. One of those is, and I see this one being asked a lot right now, is what is the purpose of marriage?
That is such a great question. And if you were to survey people, you'd get a plethora of answers. From God's perspective, the purpose of marriage is to mirror his image. God is spirit. And so for him to be able to relate to human beings, he uses a multitude of channels of communication. There's the scriptures, there's nature. But one thing that he loves to use is Christian marriage. So the ancient church believed when you look at a Christian's marriage, you see the Trinity. You see the husband and the wife and the love that exists between them is Trinitarian. So we are to reflect God's love. We're to reflect forgiveness. We're to be a human embodiment of the fact that God loves us, and we're to be a human embodiment of Jesus's love for the church. So if we get a divorce, we just shatter that image, right? If we get a divorce, we suggest that the Trinity can be exploded and fall apart. If we get a divorce, we suggest that Jesus's love for the church could end. Now, if listeners are thinking, well, great, I'm on my second marriage, I'm on my third marriage, understand that one of the best things God does is redeem us. So God can take the present marriage you're in, and it can also fulfill this metaphor of what marriage is supposed to be. God can take you from the point you're at right now and move forward into an image of what God's love is like. So I think a robust view of marriage like that, I mean, here in the States, we have the American dream. So what's the purpose of marriage? It's to move me further along the social ladder, right? Of course I get married and have 2.5 kids and get a bigger and better house. Well, God has such a bigger view of marriage than that, that we reflect his glory. So of course Satan would be opposed to that. He's opposed to anything that would draw attention to God away from himself.
In the work that you've done with marriages, what are some of the top things that you continue to see presenting as challenges to marriages today?
Well, so I would say number one is marriage serves me. It meets my needs. I'm alone. I don't want to be alone. If you ask most Americans, what's the one thing you want the most? They're going to say family. So that's what I want. That's the purpose of marriage. It's me-centered. So when I'm not happy, why stay in this marriage? Why even do that to the kids? Why should the kids grow up and see an unhappy relationship? So my dad was in a tough marriage, 48 years, but he never got a divorce. Why? Because it wouldn't be good for the kids. Today in America, we do the opposite. We say, I'm getting divorced for the kids because I don't want them to be in an unhappy relationship. Why grow up like that? Well, I think God is saying, listen, there's bigger purposes than marriage than just your happiness. Gary Thomas wrote a wonderful book called Sacred Marriage, where he suggests God's more concerned about your holiness and your sanctification than he is your happiness. So once we have a big view of marriage like that, then you stay together in the marriage, even through the rough times, because there's a higher purpose to the marriage than just your personal fulfillment. I think the second thing we see a lot is people living together before they get married. 50% of the couples in the United States live together before they get married, and it causes a plethora of problems that even non-Christian psychologists have identified. So here is Satan again, right? This is before you even get married, you're living together, and now he's having a bunch of negative habits and patterns become entrenched in the relationship, and now you go into marriage, and you've got a whole background of issues that are going to play throughout the life of the marriage.
One of those that you see so regularly, and you're seeing this, and this comes up in your book, amongst men and women, is pornography. And I thought that was an important point that you bring up with regards to even simple things that maybe people aren't thinking of, like the movie 50 Shades of Grey and how that influences a woman's perspective. But obviously there's all sorts of pornographic material that men are consuming, and they bring these conceptions of sexuality and of being in an intimate relationship into this marriage. How have you seen that affect these marriages?
Yeah, that's a great point. We just brought a guy into our class, the Christian Relationships class I was talking about, who is finishing his PhD on Christian consumption of pornography. So it was what he shared was fascinating and deeply discouraging. 35% of everything on the internet is porn. And watching porn rewires your brain in fundamental ways. And what he said was, guys, this isn't just a man problem anymore. We're basically seeing a 60-40 split. 60% men, 40% women are now tuning into pornography as well. Here's the problem with porn on at least two levels. One, it jacks up expectations incredibly inappropriate ways. When I was single, and I was introduced to my dad's porn habit at a very young age, you don't know what sex is like on a regular basis. You may be sexually active, but it's not regular, right? When you get into marriage, you realize, oh my gosh, sex is complicated, right?
Yeah.
It's like if you're mad at your spouse, that is finding its way right into the bedroom, right? So all of us, if we're married, have had the horrible experience of laying in bed back to back with your spouse, and you are not even talking to each other. And you can feel the distance between you in that bed. So imagine me rolling over to my wife and saying, hey, how would you like to? There's no way. There's no way. And so we often say at the marriage conferences that I speak at, foreplay actually starts in the kitchen, not the bedroom. Mm-hmm. Foreplay is when you resolve conflict. Foreplay is when you love each other, when you put the needs of the other person above, because then that'll bleed right into the bedroom. But pornography skips all of that. Think about that for a second.
Yeah.
I don't have to deal with any of the complications of how am I doing with the person I'm watching in this porn movie. I don't need to think about anything. I just need to click, and I'm right there in a sexualized moment, and I don't give a rip about this person's needs or feelings or anything like that. So I bypass all the humanizing parts of sex, and I go to the dehumanizing. And the second thing I'll mention is what Naomi Wolf mentions. She's a feminist theorist. She says that the female human body is just bad porn. If all you're doing is looking at a naked woman, that's just bad pornography. Porn doesn't care about the naturalness of a naked body. It always has to warp it and highly sensationalize it in really dramatic ways. This is where we get the rape script in porn. This is where we get multiple partners. This is where it's always bigger, more sensational. So she says, well, no woman can compete with that. Mm-hmm. How can a woman compete with what you're seeing on the screen? And so after a while, you just become disappointed with normal sex. It just doesn't do it anymore. And so, again, this is the pornification of the West. And this is Satan saying, love it, love it, love it, because sex is incredibly important to a marriage. And I'm already short-circuiting it before they even get married.
A part of the porn culture that I think a lot of people don't realize is the subtlety that takes place when you're watching, say, a PG or PG-13 movie that moves in these, you know, moments where all of a sudden these two, you know, lock eyes, and all of a sudden they're locking lips and they're running into this bedroom and they're just, you know, having this grand orgy experience. And I remember for myself, I got married. I waited to have sex till I got married. I, you know, really committed my sexuality to the Lord. And I was incredibly disappointed when I got married, because I had this built up conception, you know, that all my lusts were going to be taken care of. And I was, you know, entering into marriage was just going to be one sort of orgasmic, you know, relationship after another. It's like, you know, I had finally reached, you know, sexual Disneyland. And, you step through those gates and you realize that it's the sex is hard work, and it's something you have to get better at, and it's complicated. And man, did I have a lot of stuff I had to work through. No doubt spiritual in nature.
Well, I love that phrase. I love how you just phrased that, sexual Disneyland. Think about that. You walk into Disneyland and there are how many options, how many rides, how many amusement options, right? So pornography gives you all of it. I mean, it is a dark well that you can go as deep as you want to go into that well. And then you show up with your spouse and it's not Disneyland. It's like one ride. And you're like, well, I'm bored of this. I want Disneyland. And that's what porn tries to promise you, is that the variedness of it and the unrealistic nature of it. So to me, this is spiritual battle. I think the Apostle Paul, if he were listening to this conversation and he was a call-in, right? Paul calls in and he goes, guys, have you lost your mind? This is spiritual battle. And you better start to fight in spiritual ways against pornography, against Hollywood's view of romance, right? So that's when in Ephesians, right, in the original letter, there were no chapter breaks. We added the chapter breaks for convenience sake. So what is now chapter 5, he gives his clearest expression of marriage, right? Men, you're to love your wives as Christ loved the church. Ladies, you are to respect your husband as you do the Savior himself. And then seamlessly in the letter, it goes right into Ephesians chapter 6, which is the armor of God. That is not coincidence. Paul is saying, about as clear as he can say, doing Christian marriage entails spiritual battle. So here's the armor. You better get dressed as a couple. If you're going to do battle as a couple, both of you need to be dressed in this armor, and then you move into spiritual battle and do this thing called marriage.
When people think about spiritual warfare, I think they think it more of at an individual level, not so much at a relationship level like you're talking about. But in chapter 3, you go into talking about that relationship idea. And the chapter 3 is titled, How Can I Tell If This Is a Spiritual Warfare? So you talk about everyday issues with respect to target of demonic spirits within your relationship. And you give some indicators of spiritual warfare. So can you give us a little flavor on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a bazillion books that have to do with spiritual battle. I was shocked that I couldn't find one book on spiritual battle and marriage, just specifically about that topic. That to me is a glaring oversight. So I read 25 books on spiritual battle, and I asked the question, what were there signs of the demonic that all 25 agreed on? I also come up with an honorable mention list, right? But that those were signs of the demonic not everybody mentioned. So I came up with a list of signs of the demonic that every single one of those books mentioned, and here they are very quickly. Number one is inappropriate anger. This is anger that will not go away. I'm so upset at you that I just simply cannot shake it. Right? I go to bed angry at you. I wake up in the morning, I'm angry at you. Now, I don't think anger in and of itself is a sign of the demonic. And we could even, the ancient philosophers even talked about anger being a moral emotion, that sometimes we're appropriately angry. But I think what these books were talking about is this is anger at my spouse that I cannot shake. Right. And by the way, Paul really addresses this one, right? He says, I want you to deal with your anger before the sun goes down as not to give the devil a foothold. So Paul's seeing the link between anger and this idea of a foothold. Second on the list is violent dreams. I was really surprised to see that every single one of these books mentioned violent dreams, that Satan is able to plant thoughts in your mind. So here are violent dreams that you envision your spouse being killed in an accident. You envision you being shamed, right? Getting up and speaking in front of it. We know this as speakers at apologetic conferences. You have these unprepared dreams where your confidence is shaken because you're literally bombing in front of an audience. I wonder if that isn't Satan trying to really shake our confidence before we actually get up in front of an audience and speak. Next on the list is this idea of impending doom. So it's okay to be worried about something, about your finances or how are the kids doing, but impending doom is you think if you discipline your kids, they're going to rebel against you. If you bring up this issue to your spouse, that's going to be the end of the marriage. If you confront this brother or sister in your church, that person's going to hate you. So we call it catastrophic thinking. I always assume the worst when it comes to me wanting to take any step of faith. I think that's Satan wanting to short circuit our ability to address conflict or address issues with our kids, right? So this idea of impending doom. And then next would be you no longer believe the best about God. You used to believe that God was in your corner. You used to believe that prayer worked. But now it doesn't work. And you don't even know if God's in your corner anymore because of financial disappointments. The kids have turned out. One of the kids has strayed away. He's now a prodigal child. And you just start to think, where is God? He's turned his back on me. Well, man, that is classic from the garden temptation that we get from Satan. And then the last one is you no longer believe the best about yourself. Shame is a huge indicator of the demonic. So it's one thing to think I can be a better husband, you know, and I can be a better parent, I can be a better Christian. But if you start to think I'm the worst husband in the world, my marriage is over, we got a divorce, God can no longer use us. That kind of thinking, I think, is a sign of the demonic. So those were the ones that every single one of those 25 books mentioned.
Tim, we're unfortunately coming to the end of our time. This has been an incredible conversation. We want to point people to your book, but if we could just give you one last chance, you know, just to speak to listeners that maybe they're in a marriage and they are finding that there are spiritual warfare going on. What advice would you give them?
Yeah, I would simply say you're never meant to fight by yourself. Even as a couple, you have to fight with other couples. When Paul chooses to use a Roman soldier as his model for spiritual armor, we know about Roman soldiers, they never fought by themselves. You always fought in a cohort. You always fought in a division. So when Paul uses that analogy, I think the subtext is you need to fight as an army. So I would say if a couple is experiencing the demonic, the first thing to do is grab another Christian couple and start praying for each other. And I have examples of warfare prayer at the end of the book. But we need to fight this battle with people, not by ourselves as a couple, because Satan's favorite strategy is to separate spouses psychologically from each other. So we need to have couples that are praying for us, intervening, correcting wrong thoughts. So I would say fight linking arms with other Christian couples.
Great. This has been a great conversation. And a couple things that I appreciate about your book was within the book, within the chapters, there's some sections that you call digging deeper and continuing the conversation. That was at the end of the chapters where there's more questions that you can look at and discuss with others, a small group, or even with your wife, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to be in conversation with each other as spouses.
Great. Thank you very much, Tim, for being on again. We appreciate you and your book that just came out. We encourage all readers or all listeners to go out and get the book. That would be fantastic. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.